Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with The Reason Podcast. Subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us there, too. We've been talking to a lot of policy experts about whether or not Donald Trump's policies are going to be good or bad from a libertarian small government perspective. One of the top issues that concerns us has to do with how much money he wants to tax and how much money he wants to spend. So we turn to Veronique DeRougy. She's an economist at the Mercatus Center, a frequent collaborator with me personally, and she's also a columnist at Reason Magazine.
He has no plan to reduce the drivers of our future debt, and these are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Now, I mean, I will give him the benefit of the doubt that if he does indeed repeal Obamacare, like even assuming that that's all he does, he repeals Obamacare, we're likely to see a real reduction in spending and in the form of Obamacare subsidies, but also likely through Medicaid spending, which has really exploded with Obamacare. Now, this is like a big if. And more importantly, before there was Obamacare, there was Medicare. And there was already Medicaid. And there was Social Security, none of them being solvent program, and not to even mention how incredibly unfair these programs are, as you and I worked on this, as they transfer a massive amount of wealth from the relatively young and poor to the relatively old and wealthy. And he's talked about $1 trillion in infrastructure spending,
right?
Which is crazy, first, because we just don't have the money, but also we also know that this is like, it's really consistent to mostly pork barrel spending, the idea that we could get economic growth out of it.
Well, is he talking about $1 trillion in public money for infrastructure, I guess? Because Hillary at one point had pledged $500 billion, right? And then he doubled it. So
yeah. Well, so he did, but so it's hard. It's hard to know, again, because there's not a real concrete plan. I read, he's been throwing the number $1 trillion around a lot without explaining exactly what he would do. I mean, I guess his plan to build a wall, I mean, I guess that would count as infrastructure. It would be infrastructure, but I don't know if in his head, when he said, we'll build a wall, he thinks of, that's my immigration plan outside of the infrastructure side. I have no idea, to be honest. But the other thing is, like, I've heard him talk in passing, an article being written about how his plan, that is $1 trillion, is not just spent by the federal government or by the government in general. So, there's a maybe it won't be as bad as we think.
If all we know really is that Trump's spending would take us from about 22% under current law over the next 10 years, an average GDP rate, up to 22.5%. And those numbers are from the committee on a responsible federal budget. And they had said that Hillary Clinton would increase spending up to about 22.7% of GDP. We do know he's also talked about getting rid of a bunch of regulations that might have positive economic in terms of economic growth. So he's saying, I want to get rid of Obamacare, which has a ton of regulations. I want to get rid of Dodd-Frank. I want to get rid of all of these EPA and FDA rules and all sorts of stuff. Even apart from whether or not he can actually get that done, is the reduction in regulation, would that be more likely to kickstart some economic activity? Or given the fact that, in the 21st century, we've seen things like Sarbanes-Oxley, we've seen things like Dodd-Frank, et cetera, are these regulations, is it just going to create more uncertainty?
I think it would be spectacular if he could deliver on this. Nothing is a silver bullet, right? It's not just this alone, but this would be important if he could do it, because there's really no doubt that regulation not just get in the way through their cost of compliance, but also the way it ties the hands of people in the economy. It also just really creates a massive amount of destruction of things that could have been and was never there. So there's like, so people don't, innovators don't innovate. And there's a lot of, you don't start like running your business more efficiently. You also, because it's constantly, regulations are constantly coming out and there's a ton of uncertainty based on this. The market doesn't like uncertainty and it creates a lot of paralysis. Especially since, you know, the Dodd-Frank, they haven't written all the rules yet. All the regulations haven't been written, right? There's a ton of uncertainty. Sometimes for 10 years, it'll take them 10 years to write all that stuff. So I think it would be a really good thing, assuming that he does it.
And and then there's the trade-off, right, also, because let's say, for instance, and he's talked, and this was a campaign issue about, say, coal. And again, this is independent of whether or not this would all foul the air so much that we would die and it wouldn't matter anyway. But, let's say he opens up the coal industry again or allows it to, he drives the cost of energy even lower than it is now. And it's at, historic lows or recent historic lows. But then, so we have more money in our pockets, but then if he starts trade wars or creates protectionist barriers, which he's also talked about, like then, I guess there's really no way at this point in time to suss out all of the kind of different directions that he's pointing towards.
No, there's really no way. The threat of protectionism is actually, it's unclear how serious he is, but I actually think that all of the things that he is threatening of or that he said he wanted, I think he actually is a diehard protectionist. It seems to me that this is kind of the theme, really, that that he really cares about, which is unfortunate. The question is, how much can you do? How many trade wars can we actually start? I don't have the answer to this question. I just know that his threats themselves are actually probably causing some damage. But the thing is, like, I will say, so some good things, like the deregulation side of his plan, these are good things. There are a lot of bad things on the spending front, whether it's like spending more on infrastructure and then he wants to spend, as you said, on child tax credit and all of that stuff. But also, I'll say the fact that he has just no plan to reform entitlements shows that he's just actually not serious about the current situation. Now, what is the net effect of this if you add all the tax stuff that he's going to do? It's hard to assess, except that I can guarantee you, while I'm all in favor of cutting taxes, but not if you're going to have, I think you could implement his tax plan and generate some efficiencies in the tax code and economic growth. If you don't reform entitlements,
well, let's talk about the tax plans, because and again, these are all kind of broad brushstrokes. But that's what Reagan did at the start and everything. And he wants to reduce for personal income tax. He wants to cut things down to three brackets at 12%, 25%, and 33%. He would increase the standard exemption. He would add child care deductions and a few other things. On the business side, he talks about cutting the corporate rate from currently from 35% to 15%. What the Tax Foundation, which is hardly a left-wing organization, said is that when you look at his tax cuts, his proposed tax plans, that it would reduce, again, over the next 10 years, it would cause a revenue loss between $4.4 trillion and $6 trillion if you just use a static estimate. Or for them, they say, okay, well, you cut taxes, the economy grows a bit. And on the dynamic scoring, it would be $2.6 trillion to $4 trillion in a revenue loss. And again, the Committee on a Responsible Federal Budget says that, we currently, the public owns, or rather the debt owned by the public, national debt is 77%. Okay. Trump's plan would raise it to 105%.
Assuming that nothing changes on the, that's just always assuming,
right,
that nothing changes on the spending side, which is always kind of my problem. Actually, yeah. I was
Well, I mean, but we can be pretty sure if the if the past is prologue, that spending is not going to really be going down very much.
No, I know, I agree. But here's the thing that's weird and bizarre about him is like he's just like he's kind of gotten off. He's not a traditional Republican. I mean, I don't know if he's really a Republican, but. And the things that you pointed out, right, is like three brackets, just great, like simplify. But then he kept the top bracket fairly high, which is not a problem necessarily in and of itself. If you know, we're not talking about keeping it at 70%, but there is some kind of real opportunity lost there, and the reason, and now the standard, growing the standard deduction. He was talking about doubling it, and for revenue and measurement reasons, is actually kind of he went down quite significantly, which that's it's probably a good thing, but not so much to make the whole thing more slightly more less expensive. Sorry. But because it just kind of, you need to have people somewhat engaged in the exercise of you know, paying taxes, in my opinion. But on the corporate income tax side, which is the part of the plan actually that's like the best one, our corporate income tax really, really is in need of reform. And there's a bipartisan consensus about this. And the reason is that the right and the left agree that it needs to happen. They don't always agree about how it needs to happen and why. But I'll tell you what I think. So it's like it's a terrible system because it has the highest of all the OECD country income tax rate, corporate income tax rate is the highest of all the OECD countries. But on top of that, it taxes income on a worldwide basis. So it means that if you're a U.S. company competing abroad, your revenue, the money you make abroad is taxed in the foreign country when you earned it. But when you bring that money back, basically, no matter where you earn money, you are going to be taxed at a high rate. You get a tax credit for the taxes that you spent, you paid abroad. But it means that considering that our rate is the highest, right? When you're competing with a company, you know that your tax bill, right, is and hence the cost of doing business is way higher than anyone else. So here comes Trump. Who says, oh, we're going to dramatically lower the corporate income tax, which is a good thing, but then he'll put an end to. Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot to say that one of the things that save U.S. companies a little bit is that there's this tax exception that says, well, if you keep your money abroad, then you don't have to pay the full 35%. You don't have to do this, and so. What he would do is like he would radically lower the corporate income tax rate to 15%, but he would get rid of the deferral. So now imagine that he gets rid of his deferral, right? So it says, it doesn't matter where if you keep your money abroad, you'll be paying the U.S. tax rate. That ending his deferral doesn't matter as long as the corporate income tax is really low. Mm-hmm. And if you only pass that part of his plan and not the other part,
right,
it's really bad.
Well, and
so
then
that's
there's
the thing that's like interesting about him.
He's also, at least on the campaign trail, he made noises about punishing companies or, you know, fining them if they outsource jobs or they move jobs out of the country, whatever that means. So again, it seems like
his rhetoric is all over the place.
Yeah.
And by the way, one thing that's really good, by the way, about his plan, I will say, is that he would repeal the death tax.
Right.
So that's good. It's a good thing because this is on the individual side, it's a typical example of double taxation of income, which you know, is not a good thing. But what's interesting is other than that, he makes barely no gesture to reduce the penalty and the double taxation of savings and investment, but also other double taxation of income. So it's very weird. He takes this pretty radical kind of, I think it's the right one, way to kind of end the practice of double taxation when it comes to estate earning, estate money, but not really in other places. And in fact, if anything, sometimes he makes it worse. So his plan's all over the place.
Do we, you know, here in fiscal 2016, which just closed the books recently, we, you know, big deficits are back again. It was almost $600 billion. And basically the government, though, so the government spent about $3.9 trillion, and it brought in a record amount of $3.3 trillion. Why is, and you know, CBO, everybody is projecting that, you know, deficits, big deficits are going to keep returning, you know, partly because the spending is largely on autopilot now, 65% or whatever. Is pretty much in entitlements and other things that are, that don't need to be authorized every year. What is the problem with having, you know, I mean, if the debt, national debt owned by the public, so that money that the government doesn't owe within itself, but, you know, that bondholders hold, is at 70%, 77%. And, you know, realistically, when you count in all of the other things, it's over, you know, it's over 100% of GDP. What is the problem with running large persistent deficits over time when interest rates are low? Because this is something, you know, Paul Krugman probably best is, you know, is the most well-known articulator of this point of view. It's like, oh, it's a great time to borrow. I mean, there's like negative interest rates. We would be idiotic not to, you know, take out even more, you know, spend even more deficit stuff to get whatever we want because it's so cheap. What's wrong with persistent deficits, you know, and large national debt over time?
So from a libertarian perspective, what it means is first, it means that government is always spending way more than it collects, and when those, and when the debt is growing, right, it's like the government's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But to your point, actually, this year was interesting, 2016, because it's the first time since 2009 that the deficit has gone up by $149 billion. It's the first time, and it's also gone up as a share of GDP. So this year is unusual throughout the 8 years. But again, it was easy for President Obama to reduce the deficit in nominal terms, but also as a share of GDP. When you start with $1.1 trillion or $1.4 trillion, you can only go down from there. At least we hope. And so there are a lot of things from a libertarian perspective. As I said, I think it's just kind of you know that it needs to. Government is absolutely irresponsible, that revenues are not tied at all to spending. But from an economics point of view, and there's some truth to the fact that when interest rates are low, and considering the position of the U.S., right, the U.S. can handle deficits more than a lot of other countries. But the problem is the longer term, right? It's like first, if you have too high deficits, which are, again, the symptom of overspending, there's a moment where actually, first, the spending itself, I mean, there's a literature about this, like the spending itself tends to shrink the economy, especially when you measure in terms of what kind of taxes you're going to have to pay in the future. But there's also a moment where, and we don't know exactly when that is, where that constant deficit and growing deficit, which turn into bigger and bigger and bigger debt, in and of itself, it starts actually being a weight on economic growth. So, you know, economists are debating at which level of debt to GDP ratio does the economy start shrinking, as just as it's pretty significant because it's just as, it's not just like resources are misallocated and you know, and a lot of capital is shifting towards government spending and then taking money away from actually private sector projects and things like this. But it's just, it's what's interesting about that literature is like it's the existence of big debt itself that starts draining on the economy. So we don't know at which level.
Yeah, so we don't know if it's at 85% of GDP to debt to GDP or 90 or 100, but there does seem to be a consensus that large persistent debts, national debt, really does reduce economic growth. And this is what's interesting to me is that people like who are more market-based economists say, like Carmen and Vincent Reinhardt and Kenneth Rogoff, say that it might reduce, GDP from instead of being 3% to 2%. Left-wing economists at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, who, have an actual Marxist economics department, mm-hmm. they find also that it reduces economic growth yep. from 3% to 2%. And it seems like that's something nobody is talking about in the 21st century. I mean, there are people who worry about slow, low growth in the economy, and we've certainly seen that in the entirety of the 21st century. But nobody seems to be willing to say, well, maybe it has something to do with these debts that we've been running up at least since the Reagan years on a really persistent level because, we take in about 18% of GDP a year in taxes, in a typical year. And we're spending 22 or 22.5%, like it's never going to catch up.
No, it's not going to, especially considering that so far we have not yet seen the worst to come, which is the real explosion of the so-called entitlement spending, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, which, by the way, already right now, entitlement spending is above 50%. The mandatory side of the budget is over 60%. I mean, it's significant.
To end on a totally down note about the prospects for tax or spending policy and economic growth in Donald Trump's America, what happened the last time that the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and the White House under George W. Bush? Did they cut spending because, they're the party of small government and all of that? What happened?
What's interesting, because there's another danger, right? It's he actually implements his tax plan. Even though probably on net his overall tax plan is probably a serious improvement over the current situation, even with the bad stuff,
right.
The stuff I don't like in it. But let's imagine that he actually does implement this, and then he goes on a spending spree, which is what actually Republicans tend to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way the good side, the good spending, the good tax cutting, economic growth generating type of plan would be enough to alleviate or generate enough economic growth to make up for this massive explosion in spending. And that's what Republicans do, right?
Right.
This is what they do. Since the Reagan years, they've learned that it's so much easier to sell good news to people, which is your tax bill is going to go down, than to actually say, oh, and by the way, we're going to cut this program and this program and this program, and we're going to have to reform these programs that you thought you were entitled to. And that leads to the worst kind of consequences. And we know that even when they promise, they claim they even care about it, when they're in power, they don't do it. I mean, and during the Bush years, we got the tax cuts, and we didn't get any spending to his credit.
We got massive war spending. We got No Child Left Behind, which expanded federal spending on education. The child, Medicare, Prescription D, tons of regulations that cost a lot of money to comply with.
And by the way, on the job creation stuff, that mm-hmm. The Republicans, one of the things that's interesting about the Bush years is actually the job creation was on the government side.
Hmm.
Because we had to create, Homeland Security, and so it was not good. And then there's I guess there's another thing that happens is people just actually don't like large deficits. They're very anxious. They're more comfortable with large debts because I think they can't completely wrap their heads around it. But large deficit, I think people don't like those. And one of the things that you see is then you have people clamoring for higher taxes as a result. So on top of that, it's a stupid thing because you end up, you cut taxes, you grow spending, and you end up with people being uncomfortable with like too much, too much deficit, right. And they fall back on the let's tax the rich. So
well, there is that counterintuitive stuff, and I know that Bill Niskanen and some other people years ago at the Cato Institute did studies with Niskanen and Peter Van Doren, where they found also that tax increases oftentimes precipitate spending cuts, because once people realize what they're paying for, I mean, if we're getting, you know, 70 cents, if we're only paying 70 cents, but getting a dollar's worth of government services, which is kind of what we're doing, you know, it's like, why not? You're kind of a chump if you don't buy it at that price. But
which is one of the reasons why I didn't like the doubling of the standard deduction under Obamacare, under Trump, because then you get even more people out of the tax roll, by the way, which is also something that Bush did with, tax credit and the earning income tax credit and all of that stuff.
Yeah, he actually made the system incredibly progressive beyond, anything that Franklin Roosevelt or Norman Thomas or anybody could have ever dreamed of, where it was relatively few people were paying more and more of the tax burden.
And unfortunately, libertarians, they understand this, and public interest economists have actually proven it many times over. The reason for all of what you were talking about, it makes a lot of sense. That is, that it's easier, all the incentives in government is to cater, are actually pointed to catering to special interests rather than actually catering to the unseen victims of particular tax program or
the kind of macroeconomic
tax provisions
or the macroeconomic effects of bad tax and spending policy.
And exactly. So as a result, you have a self-perpetuating situation where the loudest voices are government programs beneficiary clamoring against their program being cut, or like a large group of people clamoring to tax at a higher rate, a small group of people, often the rich, it's just like the dynamics. I mean, the incentives are such, right, that it's really hard to now.
Right.
I mean, there are,
but it's true, right? You've written about countries. I mean, and this includes Canada, includes some northern European countries and New Zealand and whatnot that actually cut spending and reduced national debt pretty quickly and pretty effectively.
Yeah. So one of the things that we know, the literature has proven this, is where exactly it's interesting. It's one of the few instances where there's a consensus among economists. It's like, we actually know the kind of fiscal adjustment packages that need to be put in place to reduce the debt to GDP ratio. So fiscal adjustments, it could be made of just cutting spending, just raising taxes, or a mix of both. And what economists left or right who've looked at this question, I've shown that actually fiscal adjustment packages, the only one that are effective at cutting the debt to GDP ratio, are the ones that are mostly made of spending cuts. It's in particular the ones that are actually those social transfer programs. So that's what we called, it's a terrible word, but entitlement program. The thing that the literature also shows is actually, unfortunately, when you look at all the countries that have implemented fiscal adjustment packages for the purpose of reducing the debt to GDP ratio, roughly 80%, they choose the kind of packages that do not that do not lead to a reduction. So basically, they go either for a balanced approach where you do a mix of tax increases and spending cuts, or they just straight out just raise taxes mostly. And the reason why it doesn't work is because ultimately, these countries have not decided to break the tie and say no to interest groups, right? So they go back to kind of catering to the same people. But there are about 20% of the countries that actually do the right thing. I wish I knew what guides them, and but the only thing that I know is that we need to kind of continue kind of hammering and talking about, and we're going to be talking about austerity again, right? And what do you want to, you and I fought on this issue during the Obama years, and the Republicans were against the spend, the tax increase, and they were pro-spending cuts. But what do you want to bet that the kind of the dynamic about the side where these guys, now it's going to be shifting, where we're going to be fighting the Republicans who will not want to be cutting spending. Some countries do it very effectively. So I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but it's going to take some convincing to break these pattern of catering mostly to interest group and making decisions just mostly based on political reason other than actually doing what works.
Well, that is, we will leave it there. But, and that's the conversation I think we're going to be having in the first and possibly only Trump administration. But is, how do we build a consensus to say that we need to reduce the size, scope, and spending of government, period, without exception? And I think that's the argument that nobody is having. And hopefully we'll be talking about this, not just, and turning red in the face, but actually getting through. I want to thank Veronique DeRuggi. She's an economist at the Mercatus Center at George Mason for talking to Reason today. Vero, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And for the Reason Podcast, I'm Nick Gillespie. Subscribe to us at iTunes, rate and review us, let us know how we're doing and who we should be talking to. Check us out on SoundCloud and at Reason.com, where you can see all of our videos, listen to all of our podcasts, and check out all of our coverage of politics, culture, and ideas from a principled libertarian perspective.